Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Sunday edition. Today's date is the 6th day of September, 2009. Of course, lots to do. We have a continuing story here, a continuing saga, if you will, a new attempt here at bringing good information to the listening audience. We've called them on the website the Gates Chronicles because we are hoping to do a series on the book that Jeff Gates wrote. This book called Guilt by Association was put together by Jeff Gates, and it was painstaking research was done to put names, faces, and actual evidence to criminal activities throughout the United States and the world. There will be other books in the series, but this is the first one, and we've decided to do an oral presentation of the book. And of course, it only touches the surface of some of the information. I'm trying to get some of the more important elements of the book spoken about with Jeff. But again, in order to really understand this whole story, I would recommend anybody to get the book. I, as I said in the last broadcast, I read the entire thing in about 9 hours, and it was a riveting read if you know the story of what we're fighting about in the United States. That we are going to pick the story up where we left off, which was on Chapter 1. So I'm going to bring up my guest right now. Jeff, are you with me?
I am. Good day.
It's nice to have you back, Jeff. You know, I'm very grateful that you've been willing here to go through this this chronology here, this evidential storytelling here, because this is probably the most important set of information that any American or anybody in the world, for that matter, could learn about. We are in the throes of a multi-year, a multi-generational crime gang and crime wave that needs to be stopped if freedom is ever going to reign on this planet. And right now, we are living in a feeling that we have freedom, but we don't have it anymore. It's been stolen from us. Our birthright in freedom has been stolen, and there is barely no place on our planet that is free any longer. I'm going to start off with the name of this chapter is called Game Theory and Mass Murder of 9/11. And under that, you wrote a quote from the ex-Prime Minister of Israel, Ariel Sharon. "I will tell you something very clear. Don't worry about American pressure on Israel. We, the Jewish people, control America, and the Americans know it." Now that ostensibly is a true statement, although it's not totally fair, because this crime gang knows no bounds. Israel is only one of the main elements to their crime network, but there's just as much power sitting in the halls of our Congress and our Senate, and through the power structure of Europe with the Zionist criminals as well. So the fact is, this is a global thing, with Israel the most obvious point of power. Is that a fair statement, Jeff?
Yeah, it's sort of a nucleus of this. The challenge is understanding the force multiplier by which this syndicate, and I think that's the correct term for this transgenerational criminal syndicate, how can operate in plain sight yet with impunity, and how so few could wield such extraordinary influence. And that's the reason for titling this first chapter Game Theory, because it's very much a mathematical model. It's very much kind of a reaction-based agent provocateur model, so that you provoke a mark, you provoke the mark being the United States. It could be a person, or it could be a geopolitical situation. But once you put in play a certain provocation, then you know within an acceptable range of probabilities how the mark, meaning the U.S. in this case, is likely to respond. And so therein lies the reason for the title of this chapter being Game Theory and the Mass Murder of 9/11.
Well, and you have to all automatically assume that they have certain controls already in place to make this outcome the way they want it, that being the control of the media, both print as well as televised media, and of course the think tanks, as you mentioned in the last broadcast, as well as even the halls of power going into the people who serve the congressmen as well as the Congress themselves. and the Senate. But I'm going to go right into this first chapter. You talk about orchestrating war with Iraq and how it was required to displace inconvenient truths. Now, we did talk about that in the last show, but could you give us a recap of how the intelligence was completely manipulated? And we know after the fact that that the Iraqis are not responsible for any of the things that were claimed in the first part of that run-up to the war in Iraq.
Yeah, this force multiplying impact is essential for your listeners to understand. If you're going to wage war in the battlefield that really counts, which is the shared field of consciousness, that's where this war is being waged. If you can imagine, if you're listening to the show, ask yourself, where does a consensus reside? You know, there are consensus beliefs and generally accepted truths. Where do those reside? And that's where this crowd focuses their attention. Pentagon Secretary Robert Gates coined a very generic phrase which captures this. He said, when you're waging unconventional warfare, when you're waging intelligence wars, the most challenging combatant is what he called the people in between. So if you have a system of governance based on informed choice, then you position your operatives in between the people and the information they need to be informed. So in that case, for example, you would take this Ahmad Chalabi, this Iraqi fellow who was developed really dating back to the 1980s by Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz, and he funneled in all sorts of false intelligence through a woman named Judith Miller writing for the New York Times.
Right.
So if you read the New York Times, you picked up what you thought was reporting. It was not. It was absolute fake intelligence, and he later bragged about it. He said, you know, we're heroes in error, meaning we did what we wanted to do, which was get the United States to invade Iraq. If you turned on CNN and you turned on the Situation Room, meant to sort of associate the credibility of the Crisis Management Center in the White House with the fellow named Wolf Blitzer, you don't know when you're watching Wolf Blitzer report the news as one of the people in between. You don't know, and he's certainly not going to tell you, that he was a reporter for 15 years for the Jerusalem Post, nor is he going to tell you that he was editor of the Near East Report, which was an in-house journal founded by a fellow named Cy Kennan, who was a founder of AIPAC, which is the Israel lobby.
That's right, and he did actually work as an employee of AIPAC, if I'm not mistaken,
well,
at one point.
As this in-house journal, the Far East Report, that was a journal, you know, funded by AIPAC and founded by the founder of AIPAC.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he's not going to tell you that, because you're supposed to be. Democracy is dependent on having an educated workforce, educated populace, and also real information, to base it on facts. The country was founded to escape people who would govern you based on beliefs. You know, your belief that the king had divine right and that the sun circled around the throne rather than the earth circling around the sun. You believe that the papacy, was infallible. The pope was infallible, therefore you deferred to the papacy. Or you believed in the Sanhedrin, a sort of group of senior Jewish rulers who were answerable only to themselves. And the whole notion of democracy is we are supposed to be answerable to one another. And in order to do that, you had something called the rule of law, which has to be based on facts. And in fact, what has happened is the people who are complicit in this transgenerational warfare went directly to where you need to go to have the force multiplying effect. You go to those domains in between people and the information they need to be informed so they can make the choices consistent with the facts. That's how you wage warfare in plain sight.
And now, what they did in Iraq, in a brief synopsis, is that basically they used junk reports and junk science and junk accusations, purported them as true, and of course many of them were found out to be false almost immediately. But the retraction was on page 26, whereas the claim was on page 1, and it gave them
If you have your listeners sort of cycle that through in their minds, keep in mind we're 6 or 7 years into this at this point, but if you just go back through your mind and remember how these things were rolled out, you had Iraq was buying a yellow cake uranium from Niger. Now, to his credit, Joe Wilson stepped up and said, no, that's not the case. And in return, Scooter Libby, who was the chief of staff to Dick Cheney, one of the key operatives in this, outed his wife as a CIA operative and in order to sort of put pressure on him and discredit him. Now, Joe, that was one of the few pieces of intelligence that we knew at the time was false. But there were other key pieces of intelligence, you know, that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. You know, you had Condi Rice going on Wolf Blitzer to say we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. Everyone remembers this, you know, if you think back on it. You had the former James Woolsey, who was a former CIA director, who signed a letter to Clinton in 1998 suggesting we ought to invade Iraq. He was suggesting that Mohammed Atta was meeting with Iraqi intelligence in Prague. That turned out to be totally false. But you had Colin Powell going to the UN to testify that Iraq had mobile biological weapons laboratories, one of the pieces of false information that Ahmad Chalabi had reported through the New York Times. But keep in mind, Powell was an honest broker. He just was doing his job. He was reporting, you're no better than the information you have. He was given information. It was totally false. So that he was deployed not to the UN. It wasn't really Colin Powell who was deployed there. What was deployed there was his credibility. So when you, it could have been someone else, but Colin Powell had enormous credibility. So when you looked there, you know, you saw this fellow with a lot of credibility. And if you're waging war, again, in that shared field of consciousness, one of the most powerful weapons you have is the power of association, either to discredit, which is what has happened in the United States. We look guilty by our association with Israel, or to accredit. So it was Colin Powell's reputation that was used to associate this false intelligence with his reputation, and thereby help pull off this absolutely massive fraud that took us into Iraq.
Well, and interesting that as it was uncovered that most of, if not all of the intelligence was fraudulent, no one was held to account for it, in fact. And including the Wilson outing of his wife's activities was never prosecuted either, although they tried, but that failed as well. So what it shows you is that the entire government itself has fallen into a complete state of disrepair. In other words, you can't even get redress of criminal acts any longer within the government. So it's a terrible state of affairs, but it's very clear that that's the case. You go on here, it says, by way of deception, and of course we all know, after having looked into the actions of the Mossad and Shin Bet and the rest, that deception is the key tool for Mossad, and again, it's a force multiplier by using deception to get a public consensus built, and using, again, the people in the middle, as you described. Can you describe what you had to say here about the first thing is they always refer to these people as neocons. You know, we've got Fromm, and we've got the Kagan father and son team. We've got Ladine. We've got all of these people in this hierarchy, and of course, and then extending it out into the Congress and Senate. More Zionists and more Zionist Jews involved all over this project. It's quite telling when you look at a 2% population, and you note that as high as 50 or 60% of the most important decision-making positions are in the hands of these people. That is in itself a force multiplier. It's quite it's awful to see those kind of numbers actually be true. You want to talk a little bit about that Al-Qaeda stuff and the rest of it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you're trying to create a, again, this is field-based warfare. It is the shared field of consciousness that is the relevant battlefield. So if you're trying to persuade me that we should wage a global war on terrorism, you best first prepare my mind for that notion, because the fact is that this is a cooked-up sort of war. And so what you did, for example, there was a fellow named Huntington, Samuel Huntington, who published an article in Foreign Affairs in 1993 around the theme of the clash of civilizations. By the time that theme worked its way from a magazine into a book 3 years later, there were 100 non-governmental organizations, think tanks, academies, and whatnot, prepared to promote the clash of civilization as the new consensus. And so we literally segued almost seamlessly from a Cold War mentality to a global war mentality, this war on terrorism. And then, of course, with 9/11, everyone said, oh, there it is. We've been, you know, the book came in 1996, the attack on the World Trade Center is 5 years later. Everyone goes, see, we told you so. Here's the war. So here we have to go after these Islamo-fascists. We have to go after these terrorists. And that became our reaction to the mass murder, because your mind was already prepared for that framing. And you know, in the sort of field of all possibilities, as the physicist would say, your mind is now, before that attack, your mind has already got this little bit of a framing around it that became even more of a framing with this fake intelligence to say, aha, it's this evildoer, Saddam Hussein. Keep in mind he was an ally until turned into an evildoer. It's the evildoer Taliban. Well, no one really knew who the Taliban were until March of 2001, when there was a bombing of these ancient Buddhas in Afghanistan, and suddenly everyone said, the press routinely reported it as a cultural holocaust. Now, there's lots of words that could have been used to report that, but it wasn't. It was reported as a cultural holocaust. So suddenly you had in mind, oh, the Taliban, they must be evildoers. Saddam Hussein must be evildoers. So it became plausible. You know, my mind is prepared to go ahead and buy into this cooked intelligence. And if you're trying to think of the best analogy I can find, is a movie. You've got a cast, you prepare the scene, you go out and you find the places where you're going to do the shoots and whatnot, and suddenly you got direction, production, action, movie, let's go to war in Iraq.
Yeah.
So the pre-staging is really quite a marvel to behold, and it absolutely would be impossible without a sufficient number of people in between.
Well, they were actually fixing this story even in advance of the 90s. Back in the 1970s, when the Israelis supposedly were attacked at the Olympic Games by Abu Nidal, when it turns out that Abu Nidal was actually working behind the scenes for the Mossad as a paid, a paid terrorist, if you would. And that's all. He also took credit for the Klinghoffer thing on the Achille Lauro. And several others, and it turns out that he was on their payroll the whole time, as are many in that Middle Eastern area. And Al-Qaeda was basically a list of people who they had had working in Afghanistan to stop the Russians from winning that battle, and that turned into the Al-Qaeda that everybody refers to in news reports, when in fact that whole system was set up by the Americans back in the 80s. So this actually dates back several decades in preparation.
Yeah, I think that's the case. I mean, you'll find, for example, when we invaded Iraq, there has since been reporting that there were at least 100 Mossad agents have been active in Mosul, which is northern Iraq, kind of a Kurdish area, for at least a decade before we invaded. But keep in mind, Mosul, it comes from a word that means crossroads. And that is, if you really go into antiquity and you do a good job on your website of bringing in the, you know, somewhat ancient nature of this and bringing up the modern times, people need to realize this is the only thing new about this form of deceit is the technology with which to take it to scale. This craft is a craft of duplicity. It is, you know, the Mossad, which is a sort of, you know, the far right of the far right of the far right and the Israeli hierarchy. They advertise their agency as, you know, as waging war by way of deception. And so when your numbers are few, you need to be able to have, and this comes back to the game theory title of this chapter, you need to be able to provoke a country that has a standing army and provoke them to deploy their army on your behalf while also making yourself out as being a victim and doing that, you know, over and over and over again, so it has a plausible storyline behind it. So people say, oh, yes, we're allied with these hapless victims in the Middle East, and we're going to dispatch our military for that purpose.
Well, let's talk, Jeff, let's talk about Operation Trojan here, because this is an important element to this first chapter, I believe.
Yeah, this was interesting pre-staging. In February of 86, the Mossad launched something called Operation Trojan, and they sent a broadcasting unit into Tripoli and set up a broadcasting section in an apartment that they rented and had to be close enough to where Gaddafi was broadcasting. And they sent out a fake broadcast, and it looked as though Gaddafi was broadcasting out to his, you know, out to his people in the field to instruct them to take on a terrorist attack. Now, by then, Ronald Reagan had already indicated if there's a terrorist attack and an American is killed, we will attack whoever did it. And sure enough, soon there was an attack in Berlin at a discotheque. Two American servicemen were killed, and suddenly you had 160 warplanes dispatched from the U.S., Germany, and the U.K. to bomb Tripoli and Benghazi. And with that, according to this book written by a former case officer of the Mossad, he said, you know, they sat around after this operation because, you know, we. The French and the Spanish, who intercepted the same fake broadcast that we intercepted. You said, this is a Mossad operation, don't buy into this. And what we did instead, we went to one of our most trusted allies, and I said, no, it's absolutely real. And who was that ally? Of course, it was the Israelis. So this set off the, this helped a number of ways for to pre-stage an operation. But according to this book, in any case, so the Mossad officers were sitting around and saying, gee, that was easy. Now how do we get them to invade Iraq? Well, first we need to really make out Saddam as an evildoer. He said it may take us a decade or more to do that, but we can certainly do it, and they certainly did. And there's no doubt that Saddam Hussein was a brutal dictator, but he was also the most moderating force that we had in the in that region. And anyone who's watched it closely knows that women had more opportunities, they had modern educations, this sort of thing. And anyone who knew the history of how Iraq was formed by forcing, back at the Treaty of Versailles, by forcing these long warring tribes, the Kurds, the Shias, and the Sunnis, into one so-called nation state, anyone who knew that, and rest assured the war planners like Wolfowitz and whatnot knew that, once you fracture that rather, that government that was being held together by a dictator, once you fracture that, you're guaranteed to have precisely what you got, which is this group was going to go at each other's throats again. So again, that was all game theory. That's all, you model what is likely to be done in response to reaction or in response to reaction to a reaction, and it becomes kind of algorithms. You weight each, you put a weighting on each of the reactions depending upon how many of the variables you can control. And if you control enough of the variables, it becomes a probabilistic model. It becomes foreseeable within an acceptable range of probabilities where this is going. And that's why the 2005 Nobel Prize in Economic Science was given to Robert Allman, who is at the Center for Rationality in Jerusalem, not the Center for Morality or Justice, but Rationality. It's a very rational model. It has no morality anywhere in it.
Well, your next topic within the chapter is called Entropy as a Game Theory Weapon. You want to talk a little bit about what that means and why you named that particular thing? Because, one of the interesting things that you talk about here in this particular passage is how Sharon took a group of people to the Temple Mount, knowing full well it was going to be a serious provocation, and it was going to ignite anger on both sides, because the response of the Israeli Muslims and the Palestinians was immediately that this is an act of war, and it's an act of provocation that was unnecessary, and they used it to their advantage and ignited the Intifada.
Yeah, the last thing that the game theorists want is peace. You do not want peace in this region. You need serial well-timed crises. In order to do that, you have to have serial provocations. And when Sharon marched to the Temple Mount in September of 2000 with 1,200 troops, whatever it was, he, of course, set off this Intifada and, of course, cast themselves as victims. That was a military operation. And an agent provocateur, a model of waging war, that was a military operation. I mean, people know how these things operate. The term entropy, let me give you an example. In June of 1963, John Kennedy had been elected, and he knew that the Israelis were developing atomic weapons. He wrote to David Ben-Gurion, then the Prime Minister, and he said, I need to know beyond a reasonable doubt that you're not developing nuclear weapons. Now, beyond a reasonable doubt is not friendly language, and it's certainly not diplomatic language. That's the language that a judge uses to instruct a criminal jury on culpability for something like premeditated murder. You need to know beyond a reasonable doubt that you're not, that you did something, that you're not doing something. He cabled that letter to the U.S. Embassy, and before it could be delivered the next day, physically delivered, rest assured it had been intercepted, Ben-Gurion resigned.
That's right.
So you had an entropy strategy, right? So suddenly Kennedy has no government with which to negotiate.
That's right.
And by the time the Israelis put together another government, the Kennedy problem was handled.
That's right.
You had Lyndon Johnson in place. Now, you saw that same strategy happen again with Olmert, Ehud Olmert, the prime minister, when suddenly, the roadmap to peace began to get some traction. We had the quartet formed and whatnot. And suddenly, there's real pressure to bring some resolution to real peace, which is the most threatening thing imaginable to the Israelis, when they want to continue to expand land and take land because, God gave them the greater Israel, which just happens to sit on the largest patch of oil on the planet. He gave it to us, and we're going to take it. Olmert had this well-timed scandal that came up. You always have a well-timed scandal. He resigns, and suddenly we've got no one to negotiate with, and by the time a new government is formed, we've also got a new government. So you have this enormous amount of entropy, the turnover of staff and whatnot, and what you do is you take an agreed-to deal, which was the roadmap, and suddenly the roadmap becomes a negotiating chip for Netanyahu, the new prime minister. So rather than agreeing to the terms of the previous government and moving forward, the roadmap, the stop the settlements, all of a sudden, suddenly it's back into being a bargaining chip. And what did Netanyahu do? He bargained with Obama, another young, inexperienced president, just happens to be from the west side of Chicago, just happens to have his top three funders being Ashkenazis. And suddenly he finds himself negotiating with the roadmap instead of moving forward on it. And what does he get in return? Netanyahu gets an agreement that will have some kind of sanctions against Iran. So Iran is right back into the play again. This is classic game theory, absolute classic.
Yeah.
How's that work?
Well, it does, and you know, it's not hard if you step back to see that in every instance, the crimes that are being committed in mass are being done by their side. And I mean, you know, when this they really made a big mistake, Jeff, when they invaded the Gaza Strip, because the world did see that this was an incredible this was a genocide, and it was so one-sided. They were shooting bottle rockets at the Israelis, and they were shooting phosphorus on these Gazans. And the world saw it, and there was outrage around the globe. And I think their hubris and their belief that they're infallible against the stupid goyim, and excuse me for using that term, but true, we're not going to get any traction on the truth. Well, that didn't happen, and many countries have already begun fighting back with boycotts, with all kinds of things. And the anger is still seething from that assault. I really think they messed up on that one. But that's just my take on it. What do you think?
Well, it becomes, I mean, keep in mind where this war is being waged. Again, it's in that field of consciousness, and the most powerful weapon, again, is the power of association. And so the United States is associated with this behavior. You know, and so to the extent to which, the extent to which the United States does not stand up to this and shut this down, we become the aggressor. And in the eyes of the world, we are the aggressor. And the way this works, the entropy side of this, entropy suggests, disorder, deterioration of information, systemic sort of transformation, energy runs down, cars run out of gas, stars implode. It's that sort of notion of entropy sort of running down.
Yeah, ice melting.
Ice melting, and that's precisely what's happening to the United States.
Yeah, that's right.
We're overextended militarily, financially, diplomatically. We've been discredited. We've been depleted. It's weakened our military. It's discredited our leadership. It's degraded our financial condition. It's disabled our political will. This is how war is waged on the United States from inside the United States while deploying our military for a foreign nation that lobbies us as though it were a domestic lobby inside our government. And when Americans really wake up that this is not an ally, this is an enemy within, then that's what's going to have to happen. But they can't get to the information to inform them as to, what we're trying to focus on with this series of books called the Criminal State Series is how this happened. If people understand the how, which is what we're doing in a series on the French Connection, they will understand who and they'll understand why.
That's right.
People often start with the who and the why, and then they have to cobble together some kind of theory about how, and that's where you get conspiracy theory. So if your listeners will just understand the how this is done by the power of association, by imposing entropy on systems, by fairly simple technology, but it's a field-based warfare. And keep in mind that the subtitle of the book is both deception. We've clearly been deceived. But the subtitle is self-deception. You have to agree to be deceived. It's duplicity and self-deception. And so the extent to which people continue to think that this government within our government is, in fact, an ally, you will tend to continue to associate their plight with the plight of the United States. And it was meant to do precisely that. So
well,
we identify with a plight, which is basically a plight that they've created because they provoked so many people in the region, that they got a response whereby they can sort of plausibly cast themselves as victims, And here we go. Let's take our military in there to protect our island.
Well, as a positive note on that statement, they are losing in the court of public opinion, at least in the circles I move in, and my circles are growing, and they're growing exponentially, and so is the world's knowledge. And there are many people out there who don't fear the epithet of being called an anti-Semite anymore because it's not holding its sting it once had. People are starting to say, well, you know, if being an anti-Semite means being against the murder of Gazan children and women, then geez, I'm an anti-Semite. Sorry to tell you. And we're finding out that that these people are not winning this battle of a court of public opinion. And the best way I can tell you to prove that is that the circulation of all the newspapers they control, the Salzburgs and the rest, are in free fall. And more people are looking to the internet where we're doing battle right now, telling the truth. And they're finding the truth. They're finding at least elements of the truth. And there's enough questioning going on right now that these people are, the flow of history is against them. Now, we are still in the early stages of dispersing that truth, but certainly it seems to me that if you extrapolate out into the future the shift in the mindset of the public, these people are in trouble and they see it and they're frightened. I can sense it. I can smell it. Now, here's the next one, Jeff. Multi-point persuasion. Again, you know, I mentioned that they own well, for example, Cy Newhouse, the biggest publisher of weekly and monthly periodicals in the world. Then you go to the Hollywood connection to these people. Then you can go to the television network connection and control. Then you can go to nation states under their control. The head of the BBC is from this community. You can go to Ireland. You can go to this France. It doesn't matter where you go. They're in control of the media. And then you also know that they're teaching our children more about being emotional than they are reading, writing, and arithmetic. So they're training the minds of people how not to think. So they've got a multi-pronged attack going on in persuasion. You want to go into a little bit about what you wrote about here?
Yeah, you find that, of course, this again is you understand the modus operandi, the method by which this, you know, operation operates in plain sight. You need operatives in the point, in those spaces in between. So it's quite rational that if you're trying to be a huge force multiplier, a very small group of people multiplying their impact, then you're going to focus on those places in between. At the same time, keep in mind that systematically, I mean, this is fundamentally a psyops. It's a psychological operation operating at scale, literally at a global scale at this point. And the primary piece of it is those who are very masterful at displacing facts with what you can be induced to believe. Now, if you're doing that, one place you want to target is you want to target people's insecurities, whether it's their financial insecurity, their national insecurity, their sexual insecurity, their community insecurity, their health insecurity, whatever it is. You focus that. And one reason you do that is because that has an emotional charge to it. So, for example, you didn't just want to have a mass murder in the United States. You want to have it done on iconic buildings. So you people have people leaping to their death. You want to take out 4,000 people all in one fell swoop. So it was emotionally wrenching. Now, what emotions do, if you can get really ratchet them up, they also help you displace facts. At that point, an entire nation is put into shock, grief, which is followed by outrage, you know, about how we're going to respond to this. So any evildoer would have been just fine. But at that point, we've got a pre-staging of an evildoer, you know, the Taliban and Saddam Hussein and whatnot. So indeed, you had these, you know, these operatives on these airplanes who were all Middle Easterners. At the same time, after 60 years of the United States being associated with this behavior in the Middle East, how difficult would it be in a population of 1.3 billion Muslims to get 19 people, particularly well-educated people, males, of a certain age group where your testosterone tends to be a little higher anyway, you know, to be willing to give up their lives?
Well, but those people didn't do it because seven of those people on that list are still alive. And on top of that, there are only three or four of them identified in advance of the attack. One of them was Atta and the people he lived with. But on the same street he lived with down in Florida, there were Israeli Mossad living in apartments on both sides of him. And in fact, he was using a credit card provided him through the United States. And he was going on booze cruises with Abramoff and the rest. So the fact of the matter matter is these weren't angry Muslims that had anything to do with that. The facts all show that this was an Israeli psyop from the beginning, and that these were just the people that did surface as Islamic in this thing were basically patsies that were set up for it. But the other ones were just names on a piece of paper. They didn't even actually exist. Seven of them, as I said...
I don't have access to those facts, and I've not verified those facts on my own.
So well, I have verified them, so I'm clearing up that little part to this because I have verified that.
What I do is stay with the modus operandi of how these things operate so that people understand that you provoke people in such a fashion that their own emotions are provoked. In such fashion that they will displace their own facts. This is the self-deception part of it.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I didn't want you to go on with the 19. There weren't 19 guys that involved in this, so I wanted to make sure that at least I put my stamp of knowledge on that particular point. But anyway, go on with what you were saying, Jeff, please.
Yeah, the modus operandi, again, is how do you displace facts of what people can be induced to believe. And that's why the manipulation of faith has played such a strong role in this. I mean, how old is the notion of displacing facts with what people can be induced to believe? You know, that's an ancient craft. And now, of course, if you are someone, if you're in between, like this guilt by association is, you know, operating in that in between space, as is your show. If suddenly you are now providing facts, then what you need to do is either make it difficult for you to get into that in-between space. So, well, you know, we're now broadcasting a show on a, you know, no offense intended, on a fair, you know, somewhat obscure website rather than on the front of the New York Times. You know, we're having this conversation on online radio rather than on CBS radio. You know, so if you exclude people from that in-between domain, or you try to discredit people who get into that in-between domain. You make them look like they're not reputable. You associate them with despicable activities. You try to somehow make if you've got the facts, you've got to discredit or kill the, you know, the fact giver. That's how this works.
Yeah, destroy kill the messenger. That's right.
Kill the messenger. So that continues to be the key modus operandi. But in the United States now, you've got media, as you mentioned, in control of a group that has a shared bias. We have laws whereby you cannot own more than a certain number of media outlets in a particular market, but that misses the point. If you've got three media owners, they all have a shared bias, then it doesn't really matter how many they own in that market. So if we're going to really restore democracy and the notion of informed consent, you've got to go back and reevaluate how this warfare is waged, and people really, at this point, simply have no idea.
You're right.
So that's what we're trying to bring to the attention of the public.
Well, and you bring on the idea too of emotional management, because and again, that just you just did a good description of emotional management by saying, look, you know, your countrymen, your brethren were killed. They were killed, and then of course everybody immediately after the 9/11 attack, it had to be Islam, it had to be Bin Laden, it had to be, and they were the pundits everywhere, and of course they put the talking heads on every channel and kept showing the fall of the buildings over and over and over again, and then the, you know, they pulled on the heart.